Hi, I'm Matthew Kind. Every Monday, look for a fresh new episode where I'll take you behind the scenes and interview the insiders that are shaping the rapidly evolving cannabis industry. Learn more at cannainsider.com. That's CANNAinsider.com. Now here's your program. Today, we're going to hear about the 9 trends impacting the cannabis industry from industry insider Paul Rosen of Global Go. Paul, welcome to Canna Insider.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Give us a sense of geography. Where are you in the world today?
I am in beautiful Canada, where I am from. I'm in the province of Ontario. I wish your audience could see where I am. I'm at my country home, which is on Lake Ontario, I think the third largest lake in the world. So we're here in sort of late fall, early winter. We had a bit of snow this morning, which happily did not stay on the ground. And this is where I've been sheltering in place along with my family for since really COVID struck hard in March.
Okay. And when are they going to let us Americans back up into Canada? I'm feeling a little bit like a secondhand citizen here. What's the deal?
Yeah, you know, I could.
I know you're personally responsible for it.
Yeah, I'll just make a quick phone call and everything will be fine. Yeah. Let me say, Matt, that it's a reciprocal thing that we also are under some restrictions to just being able to enter the United States. We need to have a viable reason other than I just feel like going on a holiday or visiting. I think with the promise around the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine, I think there's a lot of optimism that we'll start in the spring to start to see something that looks a bit more normal. I do think Americans can come to Canada still, but they need to have sort of a compelling reason.
Okay. Got it. How about just like our deep desire for authentic maple syrup? Is that a good reason?
So good. I was just driving in my neck of the woods and all the trees are being tapped for sap right now. So it is that season here. And yeah, you know, Canadians, we're good at maple syrup, bacon, donuts, hockey, and of course, cannabis.
Yes. And we're going to talk a lot about that. Good segue. So Paul, before we do that, what is Global Go at a high level?
Global Go is a advisory platform that is delivering and set up to continue to deliver a whole range of service offerings to the global cannabis industry. So kind of my core thesis, which is something I know we're going to touch upon, is that cannabis already has gone global and more countries are beginning to adopt sensible cannabis reform, whether it's medical or recreational. You know, I don't have enough fingers in both hands to count the number of countries that have transitioned, if you will. And I think that we can learn a lot from some of the early countries like Canada, where I was an early entrepreneur, as to what best practices work and what not so great practices should be discarded. So Global Go is really designed to help not just emerging cannabis entrepreneurs, but either mature or emerging cannabis entrepreneurs in any jurisdiction, minimize their risk, to be honest, because this is a risky industry. And we have a whole range of service offerings, from the very basics of applying for licenses to a meaningful consultation on grow technology, extraction technology, to brokering deals by being able to act for buyer or seller to move cannabinoids compounds from one regulated jurisdiction to another, to guide on capital strategy, to guide on M&A strategy. So sort of from the micro to the macro, we're a full service advisory. I call it a platform because we've opened up affiliate offices in a number of the countries that I predict will have a bright future in global cannabis. These include Colombia, Brazil, Ecuador, Switzerland, Cyprus, Mexico, Singapore as a hub into Asia. So we're really building what I think is going to be like the McKinsey of cannabis. And when I say we, myself and a lot of really talented, hardworking individuals that all have years of experience in the global regulated cannabis industry.
Okay. And can you talk a little bit about your background and what you were doing before Global Go?
Definitely. So I'm in my mid-50s, just to put an age to a voice, which means I've been at it career-wise for a long time. My arc is kind of interesting, I think, as to how I got into cannabis, which leads to Global Go. I'm an attorney in Canada, although I stopped practicing law in the late 1990s. Matt, I was a constitutional and criminal defense attorney, a wonderful career, kind of the foundation stone of everything that happened since. But I was really more built for business than I was to be a lawyer. I just never loved selling my time by the hour as a business model. I could kind of calculate, you know, my lifetime earnings when I was about 30 years old, which concerned me. And I would really enjoy the sort of the risk and the potential upside of business. So I've been a small business owner and operator my entire career. Even as a lawyer, I opened my own law firm. But I entered the cannabis industry in way back in 2012. And that was around the time that the Canadian government was beginning to promulgate the a commercial cultivation licensing program in Canada for cannabis. And those words really got my attention, licensing, commercial cultivation. And I had a strong sense, like a lot of other early Canadian participants, that this was going to be, you know, quite a big economic boom to the country and a great opportunity for risk on entrepreneurs to enter the industry. And I did. I started a company with three co-founders that originally was called Horticann Incorporated, and then it name changed to Pharmacann Capital Corporation. And we figured out quickly that our skill set was to analyze deals rather than necessarily run or apply to run a grow op. And so we became the first Canadian investment company to invest in other cannabis operators' companies, other operators' companies. And I took that company public with my colleagues in Canada in 2014. I think we were the third public company in Canada. And then the company was corporate rebranded to the Cronos Group in October 2016, shortly after I had departed as CEO. So that whole experience, which for me lasted about 4 years, was the deepest possible dive into what a regulated cannabis regime or platform would look like. And it really blew my mind as to what the possibilities were around this plant, both as a medicine, as a wellness product, but also as a source of great commercial potential. And so I've been super active in the cannabis industry. I won't bore you and your audience with everything I've done, but I started a number of companies, one of which is Global Go. And the reason I got involved with started Global Go along with some talented partners is when I wasn't starting my own companies, I was doing advisory on the side for a whole range of, I think, great cannabis companies, quite a few of which have gone on to great outcomes. And I was never an advisor. I always looked at consultants or advisors with a little bit of a skeptical eye. I always felt like entrepreneurs do, advisors advise. Probably I was a little bit too prideful in that assessment, but it was how I felt. But I did discover that I had a knack, especially for helping early stage entrepreneurs navigate both the opportunities and the potential risk around startup culture. And so I never really thought that was a scalable business, but it was a great pleasure to be able to mind share with all sorts of cool companies, not just in cannabis, in multiple industries, learn from them, but also impart what experience had taught me. And wisdom and experience are really something that you earn over time. It's not a function of intelligence, it's a function of experience. And I love that advisory business because I really felt that I was sort of adding value and I could see the impact I was having on young companies, but to me it wasn't scalable. And then I met a great colleague of mine named Tom Zuber, another great colleague named Phil Vivardi, and we decided to launch this company together because we saw what was a scalable platform, and we have scaled quickly. We have about 15 staff now. We operate in, as I mentioned, 7 different countries, and we have a pretty incredible client list growing all the time. So I've been all in, Matt, in the cannabis industry. I sort of like, once I got pulled into the gravitational orbit of the cannabis industry, I really just had to reorient my other companies that continue to operate, restaff them, replace myself. And I've never really looked back. I just cannot express my affection for this industry enough. I love it. I love what we're doing. And Global Go is a vehicle to extend all the knowledge that we've picked up in North America over the last 8 years and help transport that to emerging economies, even if emerging means a new state in America. To us, it's all really one global industry at this point.
Okay. Yeah, every other industry seems boring after you're in this one for a while. It seems vanilla. So I agree with you. So let's talk about the 9 trends affecting the cannabis industry and jump right into the first one. What is catastrophic failure and what do we need to know about it?
Yeah. So, you know, these are 9, I think we highlighted 9 things that I think are, they're not exhaustive, they're illustrative of things that are, at least from an investor perspective or a market participant perspective, things to be aware of. So, you know, catastrophic failure in the cannabis industry looks like companies going into a form of creditor protection, a receivership, possibly being taken over by their debenture holders or their debt holders if they can't maintain their covenants. And we have seen in the last year, even year and a half, an increase in the velocity of either restructurings, workouts, or just outright failures where companies that were here last year are not here anymore. And, you know, I don't want to go through a laundry list and name names, but we can definitely see, especially when structured debt came to the cannabis industry, and just for the audience, this is, you know, highly, you know, quite frankly, fairly expensive debt with very strong security attached to the loan and usually with underlying warrant coverage. So it's sort of like a free carry on the future of the equity. A guaranteed coupon, regardless of how the equity performs, and if the equity does not perform, an ability to take over a company. And you know, one recent example, just to put a name to it, would be Ianthus Capital, which is a company that actually I sat on the board on, a multi-state operator with assets in multiple states. But they recently were unable to maintain or service their debt covenant. And this resulted in them being offside with their lender. Their lender was senior secured, and the lender enforced security in that instance. And what that meant for the equity holders was that the lenders, during the enforcement of security, took over about 98% of the company, which isn't a catastrophic failure in the sense of the company will continue on, but for the equity holders, it was a near catastrophic failure. So the impetus behind this is a few things, Matt, as to why this is happening. It's a pairing of, one, a tremendous enthusiasm in sort of entrepreneurial startup culture to start cannabis companies. And we have had literally tens of thousands of cannabis companies founded in the last 5 years, which I will argue, as the industry matures out, is probably more than the actual amount of companies that are necessary to service this industry. So we start with the fact that there are maybe too many market participants for a mature market to absorb. Then we look at the fact that this is a very capital intensive industry. It's very hard to grow a meaningfully valuable cannabis asset without a lot of capital. And we've seen companies in the cannabis industry now collectively raise or individually raise, you know, into the billions of dollars. Canopy Growth Corporation, Aurora Cannabis, Cronos. These companies have gone to market and in each raised over $1 billion, in some instances, multiple billions of dollars during their life cycle. And so as long as the money is coming into the industry, you know, it protects us from sort of understanding who are the more talented operators, who can really swim and who maybe can't swim but has this giant life preserver called unlimited capital. And we went through a period of time where capital, if not unlimited, was not particularly discriminating. So I would say that the seeds of catastrophic failure, where companies are going to unfortunately not have any future, many will, but quite a few will not. Probably more will not make it than will make it, just because of the number of market participants. It began to assert itself when there was a bit of a bearish sentiment into the overall industry, which we can correlate to more or less April of 2019. That's when stock prices started to go down, and that's when capital markets started to seize up a little bit. And so you could say that the cannabis industry, in some sense, like a lot of startup industries, could be compared to an enormous game of musical chairs, with too many players and not enough chairs, but capital is the money. As long as the music's playing, you don't realize that necessarily there's not enough chairs, or you don't know who's going to not find a chair. But when the music stops and the music is the availability of capital for everybody, then you will see that there are not enough chairs. Chairs being total addressable market, too many participants, and without capital, these companies cannot continue on. You can even see right now, Matt, some of the most mature names in our industry, Canopy Growth Corporation, Cronos, Aurora. Now, these are Canadian companies, but they're big names that trade on U.S. exchanges. None of them, and we're into year 7 for these companies. I should know, I was involved with, I knew them all well from day one. None of them are profitable yet. So if you're not profitable for years and years, what you need to keep going is more and more capital. But that capital is not available to everybody. So we are beginning to see sort of that type of market event where there is companies going out of business or going into a form of creditor protection. And I think this will continue. Even though the markets are warming up a little bit again, I still think that this will continue. And what it means for investors or for new founders is to be very aware of the risk and to make sure you understand not only how much capital you need, but where that capital is coming from.
And let's go to the second trend here, the divergence of medical and rec markets. What's important there?
Well, you know, that's a really meaty issue. I'm glad that we're going to go through this. You know, my belief is, and I think this is a belief shared but by quite a few market participants, is right now we can talk about medical and we can talk about recreational, but the truth is it's conflated into one sort of like amorphous market featuring both medical and recreational patients. And to me, if you look at the bud tender, right now the bud tender in a dispensary is almost playing the role of patient advocate. You have a lot of patients who are new to the plant as a source of healing, and their doctor or their nurse practitioner isn't necessarily strain knowledgeable. They may not know or even want to know that, you know, you'd want to use a bubble kush for this or an OG for that. It's just not traditional medicine where you have approved products approved by your health authority like the FDA, and you know, hey, if you have, you know, if you have a blood thinning issue, this is your medication. If you have an infection, this is your medication. So right now, I will say that both medical and recreational patients are going to a dispensary, which is really meant for recreational ultimately. But where we start to anticipate is that now that cannabis is legalized or partly legalized in many countries, we're finally having the type of necessary medical research or drug development, if you will, that will allow cannabis to go through a conventional drug approval process. And we had the first instance of this a few years ago when GW Pharmaceutical received FDA approval for Epidiolex, which is a best-in-class cannabis-centric remedy for Dravet syndrome, sometimes referred to as childhood epilepsy. This is what we'll call the canary in the coal mine, that in no way was it a sort of a sui generis one and done, that won't happen again. That's where the medical industry is going to go. It's going to go into approved targeted formulations that physicians can or nurse practitioners can prescribe with the same certainty that they currently prescribe pretty much every other approved medication, and that the patients more likely are to true patients are more likely to seek the certainty of an Epidiolex, for example, versus the uncertainty of, hey, I've made a high CBD, low THC strain, which probably will mirror some of the salutary effects or efficaciousness of an Epidiolex and be like, no, that's okay. I'm just going to go with the approved medication. So I say that, like, that bud tender that, you know, I certainly know and love that bud tender. I probably help put some of those bud tenders kids through university in my cannabis consumption career, but it doesn't strike me as overtly medical. And I think when I see patients in need asking a bud tender, you know, what this is my symptom, the bud tender is trying. They're not trying to be a disingenuous actor, but they're not trained medical practitioners and they don't have necessarily the body of scientific research to be able to say with certainty, if you suffer from, you know, neuropathy, this is what I recommend. If you're having early stage Parkinson's syndrome, this is what I recommend. If you're an ALS patient, this is what I recommend. You're just putting too much burden on a non-trained professional that doesn't have the data sets to prove that. It doesn't mean that you can't go to a bud tender and say, I'm having trouble sleeping, and they can say, well, a lot of my clients or customers or patients have said, try this. And let's just say that cannabis is one of those few medications that it's okay to trial and error. In fact, it might be essential because there's virtually no toxicity to it, and it doesn't really contraindicate any other medication. So it's not like the moral hazard of being wrong is just that it didn't work, not that it caused, you know, devastation to your organs or contraindicated with another medication that you were taking. But what I see inevitably is that the medical industry is going to behave like medicine, where there's approved targeted formulations that are proven to be efficacious for whatever condition you're seeking. And the rec market will look a lot like it looks right now, except that the rec market will really become more or less a giant CPG market with branding, with all the CPG playbook, you know, quality of brand and quality of distribution, quality of manufacturing, having an outsized impact upon who are the sort of the big winners in a post-prohibition era recreational market.
All right, well, let's talk about the next two, which is the end of Canadian domination and the rise of the U.S. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, as a good Canadian patriot, where there's very few things we dominate. So to give up any one of them is painful. We want to be the best in hockey, which we, of course, we are. I think everyone knows that. But really, and all flippancy aside, Canada continues to be, in my opinion, the most important cannabis jurisdiction in the world right now, as measured by a whole sort of, you know, number of different sort of measuring sticks. Let's start with the fact that it's still, as a federally legal market, the largest federally legal market in the world. Now, the United States, if you aggregate all of the states, I'm talking about adult use, not medical. If you aggregate all of the states, of course, you have a larger total addressable market, but it's not federally legal, and that means it limits its market development. So Canada, you know, with 37 or so million people, it's just a large market to be in. Canada was early. We had commercial medical cannabis cultivation in 2013, and we went full rec, I think, in 2017. So we've been at it for a while. But the big advantage that Canada had is it became the World Bank for cannabis. Our capital markets were not at all shy in a way that U.S. capital market participants like investment banks have to be. Because we were federally legal, it meant that there was no risk to jumping into the industry, and our transactional investment banks started at first raising money for Canadian companies, but very quickly began raising capital for a whole range of companies, regardless of where they're from. So if you look at, for example, Matt, the United States, and you just do a roll call of the largest public cannabis companies in America, every one of them has raised most of their capital in Canada using one of the Canadian investment banks. And every one of them is listed on the Canadian exchange because they're not able to list on the NASDAQ or the NYSE. So Curaleaf listed on the CSE, the Canadian Securities Exchange. Green Thumb Industries, GTI, listed on the CSE. Harvest, listed on the CSE, Cresco Labs, listed on the CSE, MedMen, listed on the CSE. I'm just getting going. I think I've made my point. I don't need to name them all. Right. So we became sort of the wallet of global cannabis, which allows us to have an outsized impact on the development of cannabis, because it's such a capital intensive industry that if we're the place to list a company, and by the way, I only mention U.S. companies. Colombian companies have come here, Israeli companies have come here, companies from the U.K., from Germany, they've all come to Canada to either list or raise capital. So that, just by that giving us that capital platform, it ensures Canadian, you know, I wouldn't say domination, but a very strong and enduring role for Canada outside of our own borders. So we have the largest rec market. We are the global bank for cannabis, more or less. Of course, there's capital in other jurisdictions, but still, we're still where most of the capital is being raised. And then you look at the third measure, which is who's exporting the most regulated cannabis in the world right now. And it's Canada. We are exporting to close to 20 countries right now, Israel, Brazil, Germany, the UK, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we have developed, and this is a future look of what cannabis is going to look like. We've developed sort of the most export-minded economy in cannabis right now. And we have some reasons why that is. In order to export regulated cannabinoids, the first condition precedent is that you be federally legal. So Canada can export to other federally legal jurisdictions, but we cannot export to America because it's not federally legal. And conversely, America cannot export anywhere because it's not federally legal. So this global trade in cannabinoids is increasing in frequency. Again, it's allowing Canada to play an outsized role, or it has allowed Canada to play an outsized role in the development of global cannabis, because we're raising the money, we're often exporting to emerging jurisdictions, and we're often taking stakes in these companies. So a lot of our larger, more well-capitalized Canadian companies have either bought outright or made meaningful investments in a whole range of emerging market participants in other countries. So we really have done an incredible job for a small country, for the reasons I've outlined, becoming, you know, the most dominant cannabis jurisdiction. With that being said, that's not sustainable in the long term. Inevitably, we're going to need Canada to always fight above its weight, but for the global cannabis industry to develop to scale, it's going to require, you know, quite frankly, the United States to take its rightful role as sort of the global center of commerce. And in some ways, we're beginning to see that already. Certainly, if you look at the performance, the economic performance of the largest U.S. cannabis companies, you know, they're sort of cleaning the clock of the, at least currently, of the Canadian companies. They're starting to put up meaningful revenue numbers, but they're showing profitability in a way that the Canadian companies have not yet been able to achieve. And so I think that as soon as America resolves the dichotomy between the legal, the legality at, you know, 35 plus states and the federal illegality, as soon as that is resolved, then immediately America is going to become the most important and dominant cannabis jurisdiction in the world, because it's going to have it the same things that made Canada so dominant. America is going to have access to the same opportunities: import, export, a domicile to raise capital, and the largest total addressable, federally legal total addressable market in the world. That's what made Canada dominate, and that's what will erode Canada's domination when America has the federally legal resolution. All those things will just naturally start to gravitate towards America, which is not to say that the Canadian industry is going to, like, you know, atrophy or necessarily undergo major compression. It just means that it will continue to play an important role, but it won't dominate quite the way it has.
Okay. And what about the FDA and CBD as the next trend? What's important there?
The important The important thing to note there, whether you're an investor or whether you're a market participant, is we're still waiting for the FDA to set out with clarity what you can and cannot do with CBD. Specifically, there's a whole range of issues. If you're a farmer, there's a whole range of issues around hot crops. What's the threshold? Is it going to be 0.3%? And just for clarity, the 0.3% is the maximum ratio of THC and biomass in order for it to be categorized as hemp, not as regulated cannabis. So there is a lot of uncertainty from both the FDA and the USDA about what the final rules are going to look like. But to be specific, if you're a grower, a farmer, if you will, you need to make sure that you don't inadvertently break federal law, because when you tested or when you cured your product, it tested at a THC content below the threshold, but as it cured, it exceeded the threshold, and all of a sudden you might be violating the Controlled Substances Act, which is not what any farmer is expecting when they're growing what they think is a hemp product. So we need to have clarity from the USDA on a whole bunch of issues relating to testing, relating to thresholds. And that's when that is fully, ideated, it'll be easier for the ag side of the business to understand what they can and cannot do. On the recreational side or the CPG side, right now it's not clear to us that you could add CBD to food and advertise it as such. And it's not clear that we could advertise it to in a beverage and advertise it as such. Now, it's okay to do those things if it's paired with THC. So, like, for example, Lagunitas sells a beverage, like a hard seltzer, if you will, in California, that can be 5 milligrams CBD, 5 milligrams THC. It's a regulated product. It's fine. But I'm talking about where you're trying to be an over-the-counter, non-regulated product sold at a Whole Foods or a Kroger's or a Ralph's or any other grocery store or on Amazon.com, for that matter, then there's still uncertainty about whether, for example, you can add it to food or beverage. We'll just start with that, two huge form factors. So I've seen beverages now on the shelves of multiple retailers that don't have any THC in them, or at least they're not putting it on the label. Obviously, there's not if they're sold at mainstream retail, but they're not using the word CBD. They're using euphemisms like hemp extract, for one example. And so right now, we don't know necessarily whether you will be able to add CBD to food without having to go through a regulatory approval process. We don't know if you could add it to a beverage right now, in the absence of THC. We know that it's okay today to be a topical cosmetic. That is okay. We have clarity on that. But the FDA has been going through a research and sort of an information gathering phase for like the last year or so. And we will wait to hear what the final rules, if you will, in order to say whether you can put CBD in food. So you will see that no mainstream grocery retailer is yet putting CBD in food or beverage on their shelves. You'll get some boutique, more cutting edge, smaller retailers, not chain wide, but you're not going to see it in Walmart yet. Just not yet. You will see, if you went to walmart.com, you will see a topical, but you will not yet see like a, vegan protein bar with CBD in it yet, because it's not clear. So there's a lot of sort of anticipation that the FDA could either make or slow down the development of the CBD industry, depending upon what actually they will opine on. And there have been CBD warnings from the FDA, it should be said. Last year, this FDA warned, I think, 17 companies for selling CBD products. Congress and the FDA have squared off over CBD. CBD companies have been sued for false advertising in the United States. FDA has warned that CBD has the potential to harm you. FDA has said that CBD products run real risks. So it's just a state of exquisite uncertainty right now as to what will be the final status of CBD as a consumer product good. And it is inhibiting the market, you know, potential, I will say. So when you can actually put CBD in a beverage without having to go through a, you know, licensed cannabis sort of rigmarole and just treat it like any other ingredient, like whatever else you might put, sugar, frankly, or syrup, then you're going to see a huge development in the available CBD products. No doubt you'll see Coca-Cola and PepsiCo and Keurig Dr. Pepper release CBD products. You could ask yourself, why doesn't Coca-Cola have a CBD product yet? Why doesn't Pepsi-Cola have a CBD product yet? Do they not believe in the CBD industry? Of course they believe in it. They can't wait. But there's no way they're going to put their, you know, their sort of global reputation at risk by jumping the gun. So that is the clarity that we're waiting for. And that is why you have to be somewhat mindful and respectful of the fact that these rules have not been written yet. And if you want to go out and spend, you know, $7 million setting up a CBD bottling plant because you think it's safe to do that and you're going to sell CBD beverages, you know, you have to be prepared for the fact that you might not be able to operate that bottling plant in a few months.
Good points. How about biosynthesis? I agree with you. That's a big trend there. Talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Yep. So biosynthesis, just to give a little bit of, and I'm like, if you saw my marks in high school science, you'd be like, please don't explain science to us, Paul. But I'm going to give it a go anyways. It's essentially using non-plant mediums to grow cannabinoids at scale. And so you can produce, you can use all sorts of mediums, like mold would be one example. I invested in a Canadian company called Hyacinth.
We've had Kevin on the show a couple times.
There you go. So I was actually one of their first investors back in 2014 because I understood immediately what I thought the potential of that could mean, because just using Kevin as one example, the footprint he needs to grow cannabinoids at scale is microscopic compared to having to grow plants. The carbon footprint, which is going to be very important because, let's face it, cannabis is a dirty, environmentally insensitive industry right now. His carbon footprint is teeny tiny compared to what a conventional plant-based cultivator would require to grow plants. And this is a really, really important part, their ability to achieve standardization is just something that the plant-based therapies cannot necessarily ever achieve. So the way I anticipate is that biosynthesis is really being built not for the recreational market, but for the pure medical market. And I think that when large pharmaceutical companies are looking to source APIs, active pharmaceutical ingredients, which would make up, you know, the core sort of, chip, if you will, into what they're going to produce, they're unlikely to use plant-based cannabinoids because of the reasons I outlined. First of all, standardization is really, really tricky. You can take one cannabis plant and you could, through multiple harvest in a controlled environment, still see variation. That's why we have to test each batch one by one. You can still see why this harvest I had 27% THC. The next harvest I only had 24% THC. Now, in the recreational market, that's not a catastrophic outcome. But in pharmaceutical drug development, you can't have that type of variation. You need to have precise standardization. So I really see biosynthesis beginning to become commercially viable when we have more approved cannabis therapies, cannabinoid therapies, and it's likely going to be a source to buy low cost, low carbon footprint, perfectly standardized cannabinoids. And so that's the case with biosynthesis, is it just makes sense for conventional pharma to want to get out of the plant business. Now, that's not a certainty. And let's just say that Epidiolex, which is the only approved medication, is still derived from plants. So it can be accomplished. And I'm not saying it's one or the other, but biosynthesis will likely play a role. And it could also play a role just in CPG, because if it gets to the point where you can have an isolated cannabinoid that is exactly the same as a plant, that same isolated cannabinoid in a plant, the only difference is it's a lot cheaper and it can, you know, be made a lot more quickly, then it's going to likely also play a role in CPG and consumer packaged good development as well. So I see that biosynthesis is going to play a role. Now, I also just want to walk that back a little bit and say it's not going to devastate the plant-based economy, because I do think there's something near miraculous about the cannabis plant. It's sort of its entourage effect, if you will, full spectrum. It may be that it, despite the challenges of creating standardized formulations, it's still, from a pure efficacy side, cannot be replicated precisely in a laboratory. And so I do think that it's going to take years of development and study and research to understand where is biosynthesis appropriate for, where are you better off served by the plant. And I think the plant will always be the larger economy of the two, but I do think that biosynthesis isn't just sort of like a novel idea that will not be commercialized. It will be commercialized, and it will work sort of, it'll operate on a parallel track to the plant-based economy, where there is improved outcomes. Specifically, we'll go to biosynthesis, depending on how you measure that improved outcome. And where the plant still provides an improved outcome, we'll use the plant. And largely, I think you'll see amongst either medical or recreational applications, you'll see companies wanting to have both a biosynthesis as well as a plant-based cultivation asset.
Okay. And the last trend is cash remains king. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I can go back to my musical chair comment, which is that this industry is always going to be cash intensive. And it's until you are, you know, even if you're, you know, quote unquote, cash flow positive, you're still probably going to want to have access to fertile capital markets in order to be able to make sure that if you want to go acquire another asset, or if you want to expand meaningfully your production footprint without, you know, dipping into your own account or your own working capital, having access to capital is still going to have a dramatic impact. So to be more specific, when I look at a company, a cannabis company, to evaluate them, you know, and I will do a, call it a holistic evaluation. I'll look at their grow technology, I'll look at their management team, I'll look at their go-to-market strategy, I'll look at their marketing strategy, I'll do all that stuff, but it won't matter a whit if I don't like the balance sheet, because I know that every cannabis company, what they said in their investment deck in terms of how quickly they would achieve revenue targets and what their gross margins would be and when they become cash flow positive, I've yet to see one company actually deliver on what they said. Now, I'm not accusing anyone of fraud. It's excessive exuberance about how great this industry is and how good we are as operators. But the old rule, everything's going to cost twice as much and take twice as long, is a pretty good mantra to expect. So if I see a company, I don't care if it's like we've got the Google algorithm, if you will, for cannabis, unless they've got cash on the balance sheet, it's very hard to get excited about that company, because we know empirically now that you're going to have to burn through, if you want to build a large scalable asset, you're probably going to burn through tens of millions, possibly hundreds of millions, and in some instances, billions of dollars. And I'm not speculating. That's happened already. So this is an expensive industry. It's a problem that it's expensive because it creates access issues. And another trend is social equity. And I think there's a connection between the paramountcy of capital and the as of yet unmet social equity ambitions of our industry. So cash is going to be king for a while, Matt, because there's no This is just a, in every aspect, a brick by brick, railroad tie by railroad tie industry, and it ain't cheap. It's quite the opposite. It's very expensive. It's not to say that those capital investments are not worth it. You know, we're fighting for a market that's going to be measured in the trillions of dollars. It's very much worth it. But you know, how much did Amazon spend to become Amazon? Right? I mean, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars. The cannabis industry is not much different. So that's why these things are connected. Catastrophic failure is connected to a shortage of capital for all the market participants, which is connected to the market getting more intelligent about how it allocates capital, which again buttresses the thesis that those that have capital, those that have cash, have unique advantage to those that do not, even if their technology isn't as good, even if their management teams aren't as good, even if their go-to-market isn't as good, the cash sort of levels things up very quickly.
Paul, I want to move on to some personal development questions to help listeners get a better sense of who you are personally. With that, is there a book that's had a big impact on your life or way of thinking that you'd like to share?
Yeah, that is, you know, I am a truly avid reader. I try to be like a book a week for a lot of my adult life. And so, you know, what's your favorite album? It's a tough question, to be honest. I have so many, but I did give this some thought because I didn't want to like whiff on the question. And I guess I'll say a few from a business book. The book that had the biggest impact on me is a book called The Hard Things About Hard Things, by Ben Horowitz, a well-known Silicon Valley monster. But that book, as a lifelong entrepreneur, I've started, I think, 13 companies in my life. It's one of the few books, and I've read a lot of great business books like Shoe Dog or Bob Iger's book, or I mean, I've read really into those business memoirs, but I love The Hard Thing About Hard Things, Hard Thing About Hard Things, because it was one of the few books to really deal with the emotional journey of being an entrepreneur, the insane highs and the challenging lows, the lying in bed, not being able to sleep at night, the amazing amount of stress that we put on ourselves, the sort of like chip on the shoulder that we all typically have if we're entrepreneurs. And I thought that book for me was very personal. It was like, okay, so it's not just me that has gone through these crazy, almost operatic emotional cycles in my career where I feel like, what is wrong with me? And it was nothing's wrong with me. This is just the nature of entrepreneurship. So that book was great. Another book on a personal level that I have read, I think, four times now is called Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert Persig. It's a classic sort of, it was a sort of a counterculture book, but I've been a sort of a lifelong spiritual quester, and that book was just a remarkable sort of elucidation of a Western mind embarking upon a spiritual pursuit. It's an iconic book. It's probably well known to many people, but for whatever reason, that was one of those books I read. I think I first read it when I was 17, and it took me like months to read it. Then I read it again when I was 22, and then I read it again when I was like 35. And each time I read it, it just like exploded in terms of its relevance. In fact, the more experience I gathered, the more that book spoke to me. So I've just chosen those two out of, I could talk books for days out of just an immense pile. So I'm a huge believer in reading. It makes you a better person. You can tell a lot about who you are by the friends you have and the books you read. I've always loved that expression. And I switch my reading up. I love fiction, I love literature, and I love nonfiction, especially business memoirs.
What's the most interesting thing going on in the cannabis industry, apart from what you do day to day?
I think it's the, not to circle back on a subject we've covered, but it's got to be the globe. I mean, it is what's happening in the United States in some sense, in that we're all waiting and uncertain about how we're going to move from here. The United States cannabis industry is really excited right now. The stocks of the well-known companies have been on quite a run. The Biden bump was a real thing. The ballot initiatives that resulted in, you know, six states evolving or birthing programs, all of this is like, in some sense, I think the most interesting thing. But just to peel that onion layer back a little bit more, it's what's going on in global cannabis that's just blowing my mind. So when I entered this industry back in 2012, you know, I just didn't, I had a very bullish, very almost like Pollyannic view of where this industry could go, but I miscalculated the accelerated development or the expediency in which we've got to such rapid growth. So I just see the new countries, if you will, that are looking seriously at what I call sensible cannabis reform. And it's incredible. It's shattering any sort of geopolitical, regional stereotypes you may have. Pakistan, South Korea, Lebanon, Russia started articulating now. I'm doing a webinar tonight through Global Go on hemp in CBD in China, Thailand, most of the EU, almost mostly of Latin America, all over the African continent. Cannabis is undergoing now sort of a quick sort of transmorphification from this taboo product to an essential part of a country's health program, a reflection on that it should not be a criminal justice issue, and a meaningful sense and understanding that it can be a source of great economic development. We're talking about better outcomes for all stakeholders, better outcomes for patients, better outcomes for consumers, better outcomes for the government in terms of now being able to capture through private enterprise, high-paying or decent-paying jobs, taxes, quality assurance. So it's just the speed that cannabis is sort of unfurling across the globe that is, to me, the most interesting thing going on. And now I'll just take that a step further to say what's going on in psychedelics is very much the long tail of what's going on in cannabis. And I'll say that cannabis was the battering ram that knocked down the partition to reevaluate and rediscover plant-based medication. And so we sort of knocked that door down, and now rushing in right behind us is the psychedelic industry, which is going to have transformative impact on mental health in the world. And so that is staggering to me, how quickly the psychedelic industry is developing. And it's in large part because the cannabis industry laid down the tracks. And by laying down those tracks, we sort of lubricated or reduced the friction for the psychedelic industry to develop. And it's moving in some sense more quickly or as quickly as the cannabis industry. So those are the two things for me as a long-term market participant that make me go like, holy blank, this is just, you know, what we dreamed of, what we imagined, what we hoped for is actually happening in the here and now. So it would be just the globalization of plant-based therapies led by cannabis, but with others following them, that is electrifying me at the moment.
Great. And here's a Peter Thiel question for you. Last one. What is the one thought you have that most people would disagree with you on? It can be about anything.
All drugs should be decriminalized.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Portugal's done that. I've been over there, and it's not the sky's not falling.
Portugal's done it. Oregon's on the verge of doing it. And I think that we have to understand. And when I say all drugs should be decriminalized, I mean the use, not necessarily the sale of. So I do think that there's moral hazard associated with certain street-level drugs, but I do think that the mistake we've made in multiple economies is treating a drug user as a symptom to be responded by the criminal justice arm of government rather than the health arm of government. So using Portugal as an example, we want less people to die from opiate addiction than are currently dying. And the numbers are staggering. As you probably know, more Americans die of opiate overdoses than died in 1 year than died in the entire Vietnam War. It's a crazy statistic. But the way to measure the success of any government regulation around, say, opiate abuse starts with not how many people are in jail, but how many people died. And if you can lower the amount of people that died by decriminalizing it and treating it as a health issue, which is largely what we do in Canada. We have methadone clinics in Canada, for example, that are legalized. I'm going to say that's the superior outcome. And so addiction should not be a criminal act. It should be if someone is addicted. And I'm not advocating everyone should do all drugs all the time at scale. Far from it. I'm saying that a criminal justice response is blunt when we need something more subtle. I'm not opposed to criminalizing drug cartels moving, crystal meth across borders. I don't think that's not what I mean by decriminalized. I mean, going after the user is not really solving any problems. It's just in a way criminalizing people that need a healthy response. So that would be, I guess, my one thought that most people would disagree with. And if I had a second one, I would say we're living in a simulation, like Elon Musk. What we think is reality is not actual reality. I'm very comfortable saying that. I don't know if that's controversial or most people would not agree, but I view that we are living in some form of a simulation, not necessarily someone else's video game, but something like a simulation where we're getting a sort of mutated version of what is real. And those are my two so-called controversial, most people would disagree with me, thoughts.
You know, until Elon Musk said that, there really wasn't a lot of places where you could talk about that without it seeming like some sort of, I don't know what, you know, like people wouldn't take that seriously. Now we can actually talk about that. And it is kind of compelling in many ways, like that it is he calls it a simulation, or there could be, you know, some other maybe name for it besides simulation. But you're right. A lot of more people jumping on that idea. And I think it's maybe got some merit, but it's hard to describe it while you're in simulation, right? Unless it's like Ready Player One.
It's like Ready Player One. Exactly. That Ernest Cline book, you know, when you're in a dream, you're pretty convinced the dream is reality during the dream. And then you wake up and you say, okay, that was just dreaming. So you could just say life is a dream that we haven't woken up from.
Right, right. Row, row, row your boat merrily down the stream. Finish it, Paul.
We're waiting. I'm laughing too hard.
Okay. Paul, as for the listeners that want to connect with you and learn more about what you're doing with Global Go, how can they do that?
They can reach out to me. I'm going to give my Gmail because the Global Go handle is a mouthful. Then I'll switch you off. And life is but a dream. I will just say that to your point, merrily. So, okay, everyone ready. It is my name, paulrosen44@gmail.com. paulrosen44@gmail.com. Look forward to hearing from anybody and everybody. I love to bring an open tent, and most people that know me know that I have, I will pretty much try to talk or meet with as many people that want to talk and meet with me.
Paul, thanks so much for coming on the show. Enjoy your maple syrup in the simulation, and we'll hope to connect with you again soon.
Thanks, Matt. Best wishes to you as well.
If you enjoyed the show today, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever app you might be using to listen to the show. Every 5-star review helps us to bring the best guest to you. Learn more at cannainsider.com/iTunes. What are the 5 disruptive trends that will impact the cannabis industry in the next 5 years? Find out with your free report at cannainsider.com/trends. Have a suggestion for an awesome guest on Canna Insider? Simply send us an email at feedback@cannainsider.com. We'd love to hear from you. Please do not take any information from Canna Insider or its guests as medical advice. Contact your licensed physician before taking cannabis or using it for medical treatments. Promotional consideration may be provided by select guests, advertisers, or companies featured in Canna Insider. Lastly, the host or guests on Canna Insider may or may not invest in the companies or entrepreneurs profiled on the show. Please consult your licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Final disclosure to see if you're still paying attention. This little whistle jingle you're listening to will get stuck in your head for the rest of the day. Thanks for listening, and look for another Canna Insider episode soon. Take care. Bye-bye.